6:05. Good morning. It's good to have you. Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds. Lloyd is back with us.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back.
It's good to see you.
That was my song, too. I think it was John Sebastian. Welcome back, Cotter.
Name that tune as at 8:40.
Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. I'm delirious still. I'm delirious still.
Getting ahead of yourself. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I had surgery on a hernia, and everything went well. And, I want our listeners to keep listening in the next few weeks or so, because I'll be talking with my surgeon about, you know, the different types of hernias, and I'll talk about my situation as well, and we'll learn some things. Great thing.
Cool. It's good to have you back.
Glad to be back.
It's going to be a nice day today, by the way.
Yeah.
A little chilly this morning, but it's going to get to almost 80 degrees today. So while it's it's felt pretty fall-like, it's going to feel more
Somebody going to be on the golf course today?
I don't think so. I was on the golf course yesterday.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to take a
a nice day yesterday.
Okay. Yesterday it was beautiful lovely day for the Ted Lindsay golf outing. Yeah. And his foundation was celebrating 25 years.
Excellent. Such great
WJR
work.
Supports Ted Absolutely. Lindsay Foundation and the support for research for autism.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Big news here in Michigan. A crazy story.
Yeah, a Michigan judge has dismissed criminal charges against 15 Republicans accused of attempting to falsely certify President Donald Trump as the winner of the 2020 election in the state. District Court Judge Kristen Simmons ruled yesterday that the defendants, including some high-profile party members, acted without criminal intent. Whether they were right, wrong, or indifferent, they seriously believed there were problems with this election. That's according to what the judge said, noting that they were exercising their constitutional right to seek redress. Well, the group had faced multiple charges of forgery and conspiracy with potential prison sentences of up to 14 years. Supporters and family members cheered outside the courtroom while the defendants embraced in relief. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel calling the ruling disappointing and indicated her office may appeal, arguing the defendants knowingly circumvented election procedures. The dismissal marks a major setback for prosecutors amid similar charges in other states over 2020 election-related cases.
This judge was appointed by Gretchen Whitmer. So, you know, people always wonder who appointed the judge.
Yeah.
This judge looked at the law and said she didn't see there was evidence to prove intent. And so she dismissed it.
Yeah, she said right, wrong, or indifferent. Yeah. They seriously believed there were problems with the election. Right, wrong, or indifferent.
Yeah.
That's what they believe.
That was their belief, and they, you know, just exercised their right to seek redress.
Yeah. And then you've got the other.
I mean, they signed a whole different letter, which was new and novel.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Well, then you've got the other side of this where folks are going to look at this and say this was a political hit job. These people were targeted specifically because they were Donald Trump supporters, because they were preparing this document in the event that Donald Trump actually did end up winning the election, recounts happen and whatever, that they were ready.
Yeah.
But then you're going to have people that are going, well, that is political. I mean, they are in the crosshairs politically.
Well, and, you know, you got other, you know, similar challenges in other states. So what does this mean for those cases?
Yeah, certainly.
Going to
be interesting.
We are talking about Lisa Cook. New news there. A judge on Tuesday blocked President Trump from firing the Fed Reserve governor until this all plays out. Quote, the public interest in Federal Reserve independence weighs in favor of Cook's reinstatement. This is according to a U.S. district judge. The judge said that Cook has made a strong showing that her purported removal was done in violation of this Federal Reserve's Act for cause provision. Is it the president's choice and his alone to remove this Fed governor? And meanwhile, they're supposed to cut interest rates next week.
Mm-hmm.
So this looms large over that.
Yeah, and the judge said that Lisa Cook had proven irreparable harm in her time away from the Federal Reserve, this, you know, short amount of time. But the monetary policy, all of her, you know, potential roles as a public servant might be in jeopardy here, which is it certainly is an interesting aspect of it. Feels like that this has kind of become a thing that we've seen, particularly Democrats over the last couple of months, come down with some sort of mortgage fraud, something.
There's a playbook.
Letitia James.
Letitia James, that's right, in New York.
Adam Schiff
out in California, something very similar. So just something to watch. Yeah, certainly. The Bureau of Labor Statistics came out and announced yesterday they've revised their job numbers downwards to the tune of almost a million jobs. So from March of 2024 to March of 2025, they revised the number of jobs created downwards by 911,000 jobs. So almost a million jobs. That is coming on the heels of this report of 22,000 jobs that were created.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been led to believe all the way through 2024, all the way through the election, that the economy was strong, that that we were adding jobs, that things were moving in the right direction. That was the purview of the Biden administration. Well, now we're coming to find out that we have not only have we not created jobs, but now we're in the hole, almost a million.
Yeah,
feels like the job market is like a GPS, and you think you're going to get to your location after that next left, but you've just been circling the cul-de-sac. You're not getting to the Dairy Queen.
Yeah.
You're not getting there.
And people can understand that synopsis that you just said, because that happens to people.
It's
all the
really
time.
Problematic. Yes. It's really problematic. And we've talked a little bit about do you trust these numbers? Do you trust these agencies? Well, we can only go off of what we know.
What we can see. Yeah.
And you've undershot the jobs created by a million? By a million?
Yeah.
After already doing that the year before, almost 800,000? What are we doing here? Something is not right. And, say what you will about Donald Trump. He said a lot during the campaign that these numbers weren't legitimate. We didn't know how he knew it or where he was getting that information. But now it's coming to light that there's just not as many jobs created as we thought.
I think more than likely he threw something out there, and that's becoming true.
True.
And that's just lucky. That's what I think. He did not know the numbers then. And do you know how the numbers are gotten? By sending surveys out to employers. And sometimes they don't respond in time, or they, these are why the numbers are revised.
I was watching CNN yesterday. They were playing a montage of clips of Donald Trump calling the job numbers phony.
Right.
It was like 7 or 8 occasions that they just pulled up. And I didn't even realize it was that often. But it's become, regardless of who knew what, when, why, who's, where the information is coming from, these have major implications, major economic implications.
Huge.
And we're just falling short on it.
Also, guys, Wayne State University broke ground yesterday on its $200 million health sciences research building in Midtown, marking a major expansion in the university's health science research footprint. University President Kimberly Espy said that the building will serve as a hub for innovation and collaboration, bringing together researchers and clinicians and students and community partners to tackle really some pressing health challenges. The facility will focus on oncology, neurosciences, systems biology, immunology, metabolism, and infectious disease. Then the Mayor Mike Duggan highlighted Wayne State's role in transforming Midtown over the past 25 years, calling the project another step in the area's growth. The development is supported by a $100 million commitment from the state, with additional funding from the university and philanthropic sources. Should be completed by early 2028.
Interesting. All right, we'll take a break. Some more upheaval in the Middle East as Israel takes aim at Hamas, this time in Qatar. It's next on JR Morning.
It's Wellness Wednesday, and a perfect time to check in on your mental health and emotional well-being. Whether you're managing daily stress, navigating a tough time, or just want to feel more balanced, DWIN is here for you. That's the Detroit Wayne Integrated Health Network. It's your healthcare safety net, offering access to a full range of behavioral health services for children, adults, and families across Wayne County. And the best part? Many of these services are free and easy to access. Start with a free anonymous mental health screening at DWIN.org. That's DWIHN.org. It only takes a few minutes, and it can help you better understand your emotional health and what support might be helpful. You need help finding resources? Download the MyDWIN mobile app, available on the App Store and Google Play. It connects you to over 400 service providers, local events, mental health screenings, and even food and housing resources. And if you or someone you love is in crisis, DWIN has mobile crisis units ready to respond day or night. Just call the 24/7 Access Helpline at 800-241-4949. DWIN is committed to person-centered, inclusive, and culturally competent care. They believe in supporting the whole person, the mind, the body, and spirit, through partnerships and innovation. So this Wellness Wednesday, take a moment for yourself. Visit DWIN.org, that's DWIHN.org. Explore the app or reach out for support, because your mental health matters and help is always within reach.
So Israel went a step further. They struck the headquarters of Hamas political leadership in Qatar this week. There were top figures gathered inside. And all this while the U.S. proposal is on the table. Israel has agreed to it. And even President Donald Trump has urged Hamas to agree to it as well. That basically they're running out of runway. That they're not going to continue down this road. And that the diplomatic way is not going to be the way much longer. Well, of course, that angered Qatar. That Israel carried out this strike on their soil. They said it was an international rules violation, law violation. But at the end of the day, this certainly is picking up and has not died down, even after Benjamin Netanyahu said that they were going to up their forces in what was happening in the Gaza Strip. Daron Levins, a freelance reporter, joins us this morning to talk about it. Daron, it's good to have you back. What did you make of this attack carried out in Qatar by the IDF?
Yeah, this is a rather dramatic move by Israel to try to break a deadlock that's been happening for months and months and months. Israel's been very clear that if the Hamas lays down its arms, it must turn the hostages, then there can be peace, there can be a ceasefire, there can be an end to the fighting. It's a small part of what's a larger issue for Israel, which is that 77 years since its creation, it's been at war with its neighbors, and it's trying to be a country that could live in peace, that can grow in peace, and that can find accommodation with its neighbors. And it's sending a message that the forces of Hamas, Hezbollah, the radical Iranians, wherever they are, they can't murder Israelis with impunity and then run to hide. There is no hiding from the IDF. They'll come and get them.
Daron, Qatar lost one of its own security force members. They publicly called this strike treachery. You think that Doha can still credibly serve as a mediator, or is this kind of undermine that role?
Well, for the moment, it's a good base of operations. I think there's no reason why mediation can't continue in Qatar. It could happen in Egypt, it could happen in Jordan, it could happen somewhere else. The location is really not that important. What's important is that the negotiations themselves are substantive and serious, and the U.S. administration has made clear to the Hamas that there is not much time left for them, and they have lost most of their fighting ability, but they have to give back the hostages. They have to lay down their arms, and they have to understand that they're not going to be ruling in Gaza when this is all over. So it would be better for this to happen sooner. And I hope that I think everybody hopes that the step that the IDF took by striking the political leadership in Doha will bring that closer to a conclusion.
Should we expect any kind of retaliation, diplomatic or otherwise?
I'm not sure that that retaliation is really the worry at this point. Of course, Qatar doesn't want to see this happen on its soil. But also, people have to realize that Qatar has been the place that has financed the Hamas, that has been home to the leadership of the Hamas, and therefore is deeply involved in what's happening in Gaza, even though it's 1,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts? Do you believe President Trump knew about this before? He's put out some conflicting reports on if the United States knew.
It's really hard to say. I doubt personally that he didn't know that this was going to happen, but it's a tricky situation because the largest U.S. airbase in the region is in Qatar, and they are an ally of ours. So, yes, the president has to be very careful, but at the same time, it's a higher priority, I believe, for the administration to bring the fighting to an end. And so he's going to look for some kind of diplomatic cover to make it appear that he didn't know that this was going to happen. Of course, we'll never really know unless he says something about it, clearly, but it looks like he must have known.
The Prime Minister of Qatar came out and lashed out at Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that, you know, he's dragging the region to a place where it cannot be repaired. Is that likely? Is that true? Or do you think there is still a way to pivot?
Well, I would say that Qatar's been helping to drag the region to a place where that things are very, very dangerous. And they've been doing that by sending almost $1 billion to the Hamas, by helping them to build these tunnels, by helping to finance their fighters, by helping to finance the murder of Israelis. So I think it's rather illogical at this point to say that it's Israel's fault that the region's being dragged to this place. Yes, the region isn't in a dangerous place, but it's mainly because Qatar's been promoting and financing and helping the Hamas for a couple of decades already.
You know, Israel now finds itself in this simultaneous confrontation. I mean, they're in confrontation with Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, even Iran. Can they realistically sustain this kind of, like, it's like a multi-front war?
It has been a multi-front war, and I'm not really sure what the choice is. You have a neighbor, a relative neighbor like Iran, that's been creating an atom bomb and saying it's going to drop it on Israel. You have the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, which has basically for some period of time turned Lebanon into a failed state because it's using it as a base of operations against Israel. You have an uprising on the West Bank, and then, of course, the problems in Gaza. So, yes, it's a multi-front war. And if you're Israel, all you have to do is look at the map to understand that there's not really any choice but to fight this, to defend your country. I mean, this is a country. We have more than 100 countries in this world. What other country has to put up with this? The same kinds of military attacks from its neighbors as Israel.
I asked you this question last time. We talked about post-war and Israel's efforts to build ties with other Arab nations. Does that put this in jeopardy?
Yeah, it certainly puts it in jeopardy, but I know that the United States and that Israel, and it's very obvious, want to continue the work of the Abraham Accords, which brought ties between Israel and the Gulf states other than Qatar, which are attempting to bring Saudi Arabia in, which brought Morocco in, which brought Sudan in. And Israel wants to normalize its relations with its neighbors, but it can't. But it has to be on a reasonable peace basis, and a basis that is leading to mutual economic and human benefits for everybody in the region. Israel's held that possibility out for everyone, that desire for everyone to come to some kind of accommodation that can allow families to grow and people to travel and people to get up in the morning without having to worry about being hit by a missile.
Daron Levin, I always appreciate the insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, when things like this happen, these kind of attacks happen, an important question we'll ask you on the other side, because there's humanity involved here. There's obviously politics at play. That's coming up on JR Morning.
Paul W. Smith can be found on Focus from noon to 2 p.m. on 760 WJR. Now back to JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds.
I'd love to get your thoughts. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. And this is a little bit broad because I think that there's a lot of different ways that we can look at this. And as compassionate people, we can look at what's happening in the Middle East and go, yeah, it's horrendous.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's people dying. Yeah, there's people starving. Nobody wants that. It's gross. It's 2025. What are we doing? Right. We can look at it like that. There's also, this is war, right? This is the realities of what it is. It's ugly. It's nasty. But when Israel is taking these additional steps, when they're targeting these senior Hamas officials now in places outside of the Gaza Strip, you start getting into a little bit of a murky place. You start now launching attacks on a U.S. ally. You start launching attacks in the country where there is the largest military base in the Middle East. That becomes problematic from a political perspective. with the relationship between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. But when things like this happen, in this instance, what's more important? Is it accountability? Is it transparency? Or is it this effort to rebuild, you know, mend a fence in trust that may have been lost here? And I want, we could take this however you want, but I think that there's a lot at play here.
It is. And I think also, you know, as you said, they're an ally. And some people think that Israel is trying to sabotage the peace talks because Qatar has been the mediator here, trying to get things in order and trying to, you know, get the hostages freed and get this ended. And then they get a strike in their country. And I don't know if this sets that back. I mean, I get, it doesn't matter where the talks happen, but they have been happening and Qatar has been the mediator. And I don't know how that improves anything other than the fact that Israel is just trying to make sure Hamas is gone, cutting its head off the snake, wherever it is.
800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR.
To Daron's point, Qatar is part of these ceasefire talks and trying to mediate, but they've also funded Hamas in different points in time. Mm-hmm. So from Israel's point of view, they're not, you know, totally scot-free here in terms of responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's this perception that the United States isn't able to rein in what Israel wants to do because President Trump, Steve Witkoff want a ceasefire deal. They want the hostages back, and they've been working very hard on that. This seems to undermine that.
Absolutely.
And it looks like the president isn't, you know, like in charge here, that they can't.
The president being Donald Trump?
Right.
Okay.
That he can't keep security and safety of the Gulf states because he wasn't able to stop this. Allegedly, Steve Witkoff called Qatar 10 minutes after it happened.
Yeah, and they weren't happy. They were really not happy. They said that they didn't know. I don't know how much I'm
not with a U.S. base like 13 kilometers.
Hello.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
It does not.
I mean, you got one of your guys off in a particular direction, and all of a sudden he's hurt because, no, I just don't buy it.
No.
I don't buy it. But I think that this really depends on which perspective you're taking. If you want to take Israel's perspective, yeah, they want accountability. They want this to be, the IDF and whatever Benjamin Netanyahu is doing, I think that's a different way of thinking. I think if you're just like us, you're just people in the community, mm-hmm. I think there are people that are still hurting from what happened. I think people still feel like you still have hostages of ours and we want them back. And I think that there's still a group of people that want accountability. They want this to be over in the way that the IDF is carrying it out. But then Israel's taken a lot of steps where they have not been overly transparent, and they've taken military action on civilian areas,
yes,
or at least perceived civilian areas, and they've said, oopsie, we're going to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's problematic as well. I think that this is, it's been messy, but it's getting messier because I don't know what kind of trust there is to rebuild in the Middle East. It feels a little bit fractured to the point of how do you, you know, it's like, you know, you do something bad to your neighbor and the next day you're supposed to just be like, hey, Tim, how you doing? Like, it just doesn't, it feels like there's got to be something done before that.
Well, they talked about the Abraham Accords we talked with Daron, but the United Arab Emirates, who led the push in 2020, condemns this strike.
Yes.
And people are very upset right now with this strike. So did that undermine everything?
800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. And I think there's an issue here with those at the top. You mentioned Donald Trump, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu. Is there an open line of communication there when something like this happens? We don't know. But we're counting on you guys to be the cooler heads in the room.
Yeah.
Now, you're at war, you're taking this action, Benjamin Netanyahu, that's fine, you're going to do your thing. But I think that there needs to be questions answered if those questions should arise like this.
I think there is transparency when Donald Trump, you know, talks to Benjamin Netanyahu and says, I want you to do a certain type of thing, and Benjamin Netanyahu agrees and he does it. But when it's the other way around, when Benjamin Netanyahu wants to do something, I don't know if he necessarily tells right away what he's doing.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Kevin's a warning. He's got thoughts. Hey, Kevin.
Yeah, hey, guys. You know, the thing that surfaces all the time when I think about that, and my heart breaks for all the innocent people that are stuck in the middle of all of this, is that you have a side that doesn't believe Israel has a right to exist. They just don't believe that. That's a different thing than back in the Cold War. It's a different thing in World War II. It's a different thing in some of these other things. Well, we know what the Holocaust is all about, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the end of the day, how do you not fight that? How do you they're not saying, you know, okay, we can figure this out. They're saying you don't have a right to exist, period.
Yeah, and that's really the crux of the issue. I mean, that's hundreds of years long question.
Because really, how do you negotiate that?
You don't. Yeah, you don't negotiate it.
Yeah.
You don't negotiate it. And this has been a problem in the region for a long time.
But how do you get rid of every person who has that thought?
How do you what?
Get rid of every person who has that thought. If they're targeting Hamas leaders, sure, but there are lots of people who have the thought.
No, it's not. Yes. It's not just Hamas. It's not
exactly.
Just Gaza.
No,
that
right.
Doesn't believe Israel has a right to exist. I think that's where that's where the leadership comes into play. It's where the questions of where the region goes after this, because eventually this will end. We think, eventually it's going to come to an end. So where do we go from there? What happens after that? And hopefully that's sooner rather than later. Hopefully this ceasefire deal or this peace deal that the United States has laid out, that Israel's agreed to, feels unlikely that Hamas would agree to it, but we'll see.
Yeah.
I mean, what happens after that? I mean, I think there's also a perception change on the global stage about what Israel's doing because of some of their actions, because of some of the things that we've seen on TV with these emaciated kids or aid not being able to reach particular places in Gaza. I mean, Rashida Tlaib came out and in one of her remarks, I believe it was here in Detroit, she said, outside the decaying halls of the empire in Washington, D.C., we are winning. They are scared. That's leading to a censured vote, potentially, for Rashida Tlaib in Congress. But there is a perception that, you know, is Israel the bad guy here because of the actions that they've taken recently, kind of forgetting about how this whole thing started on October 7th.
Exactly.
I don't think anyone forgets how this started, but there has to be some realistic peace ideas come. Like, just like in the Russia sort of situation, they're like, okay, like, it's not great that President Putin started this, but let's come to an agreement and they may get some territory. I think people are trying to be realistic and how do we end this thing? And I think Israel's one track. Let's get rid of every Hamas leader. Until that's done, we're not done.
6:44, time for this week's S&P Global Mobility Minute with Stephanie Brindley.
Vehicle sales have remained robust this year despite a drastic shift in U.S. trade policy, and sales are up 3.8% through August. This is largely because automakers have held prices in check throughout spring and summer. They absorbed sharp cost increases rather than creating price instability or risk creating an unintended competitor pricing advantage. So far, most 2026 model year pricing changes have been modest, though trim levels and standard versus optional content is being massaged. Automaker restraint prevented price hikes. Also, earlier in the year, some consumers bought ahead to avoid expected price changes, and EV sales are hot in the third quarter with the pending end for federal incentives. Despite economic uncertainty, consumers have continued to spend. S&P Global Mobility forecasts 2025 sales of 16 million units, even with 2024. This will translate into slower sales in the final quarter of this year. Affordability will be an increasing issue in the year to come, and we see sales in 2026 falling 2%. I'm Stephanie Brindley with this week's Automotive Minute from S&P Global Mobility.
Hey, coming up in 1 hour from now, 7:49, give you an opportunity to win tickets to go see the Trans-Siberian Orchestra live in concert December 27th at Little Caesars Arena, 7:49. Give you that opportunity.
Republican leaders in the Senate preparing for a major rules change that would allow them to confirm President Donald Trump's nominees in groups instead of holding individual votes on each one. And supporters say the move is needed to speed up the confirmation process, while critics argue it weakens the Senate's ability to fully vet the president's picks. Well, to break down what's at stake and what this could mean for Washington going forward, we're joined by Fox correspondent, WJR contributor Ryan Smales. Ryan, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Lloyd. How are you?
I'm good. This nuclear option has been used before by both parties, but, you know, how does this new version compare to the past changes, and why is it so significant right now?
Well, this has kind of been focused on lower-level and cabinet-level nominees. You know, there's been talks about doing this to other positions in the past, but, you know, Leader Thune seems to be very strategic when it comes to who they're trying to do this with. So they're trying to focus on ambassador roles as well as non-high-profile picks, and trying to focus specifically on people who are not considered to be controversial or might have some type of bipartisan support, and trying to vote them in groups and making this go quickly. So it would still not apply to, you know, positions like the CDC director or you know, the UN ambassador. Those roles that still need to be filled by the Trump administration, those would still take some time.
So how would this work then if they change the rules?
Well, they would pretty much be allowed to take a big group of these nominees who are outstanding, whether they're an ambassador position or a lower level, you know, position like a deputy or something like that. And they'd be able to pretty much just vote them in groups. So, OK, you 10 go here. Let's do a voice vote on this. You 10 go here. And that would, you know, because right now the way it's working is that every single one of these positions, whether it's a lower level ambassador role or it's a non-high profile position like in the Justice or something like that, they have to pretty much do an entire roll call vote. They have to do debate. They have to do this very long, drawn out process. And it's really consuming a lot of the Senate's time to the point that they, in some cases, have to be very strategic about what legislation they push forward.
There's also these reports out that there is some movement, some forward movement in the Jeffrey Epstein push by some Congress members to try to bring this to light. There's a report in the New York Times that says that this is getting to the point where it might be a success. They might get this to a vote. Where is that at this point?
Right now, they need to have just a few more people sign it on the Democrat side, and then they need two more Republicans, and then they can force a vote on the discharge petition and pretty much get the Jeffrey Epstein vote to the floor. So, yes, they are pretty close to the point that if they just get two more Republicans to jump on board with this, they might be able to get it there.
You know, back to this rule change, Ryan, at one point, the Democrats and the Republicans seemed close to a bipartisan deal until, as Senator Schumer put it, the president personally told him to go to H-E-L-L. What happened behind the scenes that caused those talks to collapse?
Good question. You know, Schumer has been a pretty fierce critic of this from the start. This is probably one of his few ways to really have leverage over the Republicans. And, you know, President Trump has not exactly been patient about this. You know, he's getting a little frustrated. It's kind of like, you know, watching your NFL team have two new coordinators on the field. And, you know, you have to realize that it's going to take some time to get them across the finish line or get them to start having, you know, production. But right now it's not happening. And that's kind of the thing with President Trump right now, is that he's watching this go down. And he's got a lot of people that he wants in place, but it's moving at a snail's pace. And also keep in mind, too, this is the only time this has really ever happened to this point. Thune likes to point out that this is the only president to this point in his presidency who has not had either a roll call vote or a unanimous consent or voice vote for any one of his nominees. So that's been frustrating.
What if you're of the point of view that you really need to vet all of these people who are going to have not executive level jobs or lifetime appointments, but very important jobs in the government, and you have no sunlight if they're just voted in groups?
Well, you would still have to go through the committees and have those votes there, and there would still be meetings and the vetting process before that. It's pretty much, I think, how they want to do this is go about just specifically the roll call vote. Where, you know, you have to go one by one, you have to change the procedure, you have to end debate, all that. They want to be able to just to vote them quickly, because it takes a while to vote in the Senate, believe it or not. And when you actually watch it go down, you're like, wow, this really does consume a lot of the Senate's time. So they would still have to go through their respective committees and still have to get endorsements. And that's why I think GOP leadership is trying to make it clear that they're focusing on the ones who are considered to be non-controversial or at least have some type of bipartisan support towards them.
Looking down the road, Ryan, you know, do you think this move kind of sets the stage for faster government action, or is it going to just cause deeper partisan warfare in Washington?
You know, we'll have to wait and see. You know, you have to keep in mind that this has been talked about in the past. This has been something that has been considered by both sides, where they've said that they've honestly, some of them feel that there are just too many positions in the executive branch and in the president's office that requires Senate confirmation. So there has been talks about changing these rules in the past. It's not been acted on to this extent just yet. So this is kind of what's forcing it. But there have been bipartisan talks about this in the past that the Senate's floor time is just simply eaten up too much with appointing positions.
Ryan Smells, Fox correspondent, WJR contributor. Always a pleasure getting your insight. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you, Lloyd.
The other thing going on, of course, is the Epstein situation. And I don't know if Ryan is one of them. We could have asked him. But all these lawmakers were asked, what do they think of the signature and the caricature and drawing in the Epstein birthday book? Byron Donald had a very succinct answer.
From what I see, it's not a signature. I've seen Donald Trump sign a million things.
This doesn't look like his signature to you?
Nope. Doesn't look like it. I've watched him sign nonstop.
Okay.
I don't know.
When I saw pictures, you know, and they showed pictures of when he was just signing the one name as opposed to how he signs now. And a lot of them look the same to me, but okay.
Here's the president on the Epstein birthday letter.
It's not my signature. And it's not the way I speak. And anybody that's covered me for a long time know that's not my language. It's nonsense. And frankly, you're wasting your time. All you do is trying to get off the great success of D.C. and about 200 other things we've done that are so successful.
Yesterday was funny. I heard him talking about he doesn't draw. Because in this particular picture, it's a silhouette or an outline
of a female body.
And Trump's like, I don't draw. That's not what I do. I don't do that. Sometimes I'll draw a building with a little roof on top and I'll sign that. He goes, but I don't draw.
The explanations now are getting ridiculous.
I did think that was a little funny. I did.
All right, coming up, guys, Wayne County treasurer, he's asked to pause the foreclosure on some Detroit homes under $50,000. That's next.
It's not just morning. It's a JR morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on 760 WJR and on the WJR app, where Michigan comes to talk.
7:05, good to have you this morning. This Epstein story continues to be a big one. It's just not going away.
It's not going away. And, you know, everyone got to the lawmakers and Caroline Leavitt after the release of that picture and seemingly Donald Trump's signature there on that birthday book entry. Here is Caroline Leavitt on this letter.
I did not say the documents are a hoax. I said the entire narrative surrounding Jeffrey Epstein right now that is absorbing many of the liberal cable channels on television is a hoax that is being perpetuated by opportunistic Democrats like Ro Khanna and the others whom you saw on that press conference outside of Capitol Hill who are trying to push this hoax against the President of the United States.
So because they said, how's it a hoax if this came directly from the Epstein estate? And she's like, well, the documents aren't a hoax, but this whole like discussion is a hoax.
Yeah. So I don't, hoax is not the right word.
It's not.
It's not the right word. Mm-mm. But I was watching an interview yesterday with a Democratic congressman from Illinois who was asked if Democrats should have done something when they had power, when President Joe Biden was in office. And he said, yes, of course we should have, but that's not the case now. And now it's Donald Trump's issue that he's got to deal with, and he should release this. And it's like, well, that's easy for you to say now. It's easy for you to say when the heat's not on you, and now the spotlight's on somebody else. Yeah. Of course it's easy for you to say. Not to say that it shouldn't be released. Not to say that this isn't information that we should all be known.
Bringing that up, that the Democrats haven't done it, that doesn't change the fact that there are victims who are the perpetrators.
Right.
So like
right.
Both sides using that argument that it should have been done sooner is kind of moot.
It's moot. The realities are there are victims. But, I mean, that's the the game that they play at this point.
One more thing. Have you seen the signatures? And do they look like signatures that he had signed to personal letters in the 90s? Somewhat looks similar, does it not?
Looks similar.
Here's Caroline Leavitt on that.
The president did not write that letter. He did not sign those documents. He maintains that position, and that position will be argued in court by his lawyers. The president is very confident he is going to win this case.
Odd to use the term position. That's our position on this.
His position.
Yeah.
I mean, she's his spokesperson, so I guess that's maybe just he just told her that's
right.
I didn't write it. I didn't sign it. Although, I will say, I mean, the signatures do look very similar.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure.
No way to tell that it's his, but it does look similar.
You know, I'm sure they'll have people testifying, you know, who look at signatures and compare signatures and experts. And
you ask Ryan, though. I'm sure that you could find. I mean, I was, Fox had somebody on there like, I talked to three different writing sample specialists, and they said it is not the same signature.
You could get an expert to say whatever
you want them to say. Yeah. True, yeah. A coalition of high-profile officials in Wayne County, they're urging Treasurer Eric Sabree to halt foreclosures on owner-occupied homes valued under $50,000, calling Detroit's property tax system regressive and unfair. Now, the Coalition for Property Tax Justice, including Representative Rashida Tlaib, County Executive Warren Evans, and Detroit City Council President Mary Sheffield, warns that over 800 homes could be at risk due to unconstitutional overassessments of low-value properties. The coalition says the practice deepens racial and economic inequities, disproportionately impacting vulnerable residents. The annual auction for foreclosed homes set to begin today. Sabree has defended his office's approach, noting homeowners owing less than $1,000 typically aren't foreclosed on, and the county works with residents to resolve unpaid taxes. A University of Chicago study found many low-value Detroit homes are assessed at more than 50% above market value. And advocates say moratoriums and reforms are needed to protect families and stabilize neighborhoods.
So what's the divide here? How I'm confused. If they are behind on their payments and they're up for foreclosure, what is divide here?
They're saying these homes that are $50,000 or less are being assessed more than they should be,
because they're overvalued.
Yes.
Okay. Exactly. Got it. All right. Fair enough.
Here's a quote. In retrospect, I think it was recklessness. Mm-hmm. Who do you think said that?
Oh, a guy could be anybody.
It's a little vague. That's Kamala Harris writing in her new book, which was published, excerpts anyway, this morning in The Atlantic. The book's called 107 Days, and she's talking about letting Joe and Jill Biden decide on their own whether the then president should have run for reelection. Quote, it was Joe and Jill's decision. We all said that like a mantra, as if we'd all been hypnotized. The stakes were simply too high. This wasn't a choice that should have been left up to an individual's ego and an individual's ambition. It should have been more than a personal decision. This is the book.
Wow. 107 days.
107 days about her time running for president.
I don't know. I'm lost because it's just so clearly not what you said.
No.
For 107 days. And I just have a little less sympathy for you and the situation that you had when you were out talking about how great this man was and how unbelievable and you have father figure and blah, 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 blah. When in reality, you could have just said, hey, I feel like we should have done this already. Like, be truthful. Be honest.
Yeah. But it's politics. You know, that wasn't
and she's
happen.
Haunted by that view question and answer where they're like, is there anything you would have done differently? And she's like, absolutely not.
No, does she mention that in there? They don't say
I don't see that in
the book's
excerpt.
Not out yet, right?
No, these are just excerpts.
Yeah, but that one really flipped things.
Of course it did. Yeah. Because you could say, even though now we know that the jobs weren't there, 911,000
right,
jobs
exactly.
just got redacted
right.
from reversed from the BLS. But now it's like the people weren't feeling that the economy was good. People weren't feeling it. They were still paying more.
Yeah.
And so when you say, well, the economy's great, that's not how people were feeling.
Because, you know,
and they weren't in touch with that.
Because even locally, you know, here, Mary Sheffield has been asked that question, you know, what would you do differently?
Sure.
And she didn't say nothing. She said, I would probably concentrate more on the neighborhoods.
Yeah. You know, it's an answer.
It's an answer.
You cannot like it or you could disagree with
That's it.
But it's an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. 7:12, time for WDJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. As the popularity of podcasts continues to surge, here's a tip for you. If you want to reach and target the Gen Z demographic, focus on podcasting, especially at this time of year. New data shows that podcast consumption amongst Gen Zers during the back-to-school season increases significantly. Spotify has just released a report on how back-to-school routines impact the Gen Z users of its app, showing that mornings become high-attention listening windows for podcast and streaming music alike. Its data shows that in the U.S., podcast streams jumped 19% in the 7 a.m. hour and 18% in the 8 a.m. hour versus those time slots during the summer months. And the back-to-school mindset also seems to be helping shape which podcast Gen Z is listening to. Spotify says it sees a 23% increase in science podcast listening for this age group over the summer months. And there's also a 20% bump in listening to business and technology podcasts during this period of time. And here's a bonus for you. While listening goes up amongst younger people, it also increases amongst the parents of those young people as well. Spotify says its internal data finds that parents on its free tier are increasingly streaming podcasts and audiobooks during September versus the summer months, as listening in the car to and from those school drop-offs becomes a way of life during this time of year. So want to reach an audience that has major buying power during this time of year? Target Gen Z and their parents by focusing on podcasts to make it happen. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So Department of Health and Human Service Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. unveiled the Make America Healthy Again report. It was released yesterday. And one of the big takeaways is the prioritize to scrutinize vaccines, different types of prescription drug use. All of that is in there. But Robert F. Kennedy has talked a lot about how the United States is the most unhealthy country in the world, that a major driving contributor to that, to our health, food colors and food additives and GMOs and different pesticides that are used in the growing process of our foods. Is this going to move the needle? Will we become healthier as a result of some of these changes? Let's bring in Dr. Bina Nagapala, the family physician at Cornerstone Medical Group in Clinton Township. Doc, it's great to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
In this report, have you looked at it? What do you think of it? Is this something that you think will make America healthier?
I have to say, I haven't taken a look at it. You said it came out yesterday, so I don't know much about it. But I do feel that food additives and other additives to our food does impact our health. So I think there is some basis of truth in that report that's out there.
Doctor, a lot of people who are hesitant about vaccines say they're just simply worried about the safety of the vaccines. How do you begin that conversation in a way that where you can still build trust rather than confrontation?
You know, vaccines are the most studied out there. We have plenty of studies worldwide that show us that vaccines are very safe, very effective. There's huge, robust studies, and this is spanning across many countries. Millions of children have been in these studies. There's been a lot of data out there that vaccines are very effective and safe to be given to children and adults.
A part of this also is fluoride in drinking water. It's mentioned in this report, and we've talked about it previously, how it staves off cavities, and everyone says that the levels in America are safe. But Kennedy wants it gone because he says too much fluoride can lead to bone and brain problems. Is there any research there?
There is data that fluoride does help with cavities. Yes, it also helps with bone growth, but mainly cavities. Yeah, and I don't know much data that out there that is that causes other side effects that he's talking about at this time.
Dr. Brianna Nagapala, thank you for your time, your insight. Really appreciate it.
And thank you for having me.
Yep, certainly. Part of what this draft talks about is, because there was a leaked draft back in August.
Right. And this is pretty similar to that leaked draft.
Pretty similar. There have been a few different tweaks, but it's pretty similar to what it was. And again, they talk a lot about what the causes of autism are.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a medical cause to autism, that's something that Secretary Kennedy has talked a lot about, said that they're going to get to the bottom of this and they're going to figure out what causes autism, and a comprehensive report is coming. We haven't seen that report yet.
Right.
But I think that the main focus here, and I agree with him wholeheartedly, of what is being put in our food. The different additives, the different preservatives, the different oils, all of the pesticides that are used in our foods. It's how do you get an avocado from Mexico into my grocery store in Southwest Oakland County, and then I still have to wait another week for it to ripen, right?
Right.
I mean, that's just not natural. So there this idea of what's in our food, how it's being grown to keep it good longer, I think is all worthy of discussion. I think you start to influx the political stuff and this polarization of these ideas that dramatically shake up the foundation of what we've been going on mm-hmm. for a long time on medicines and vaccines. Yeah, that's where you get the real fork in the road on a lot of these issues.
Well, when it comes to vaccines, too, there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy. A lot of parents are deciding not to, you know, vaccinate their children. They fear what's in the vaccines and don't think they'll help. And that's one thing. A parent has a right to decide whether, you know, what they're going to put into their kid. You know, I understand that. But when you're in school and kids in a school setting, there are some kids who are immunocompromised who can't take a vaccine, and they depend on the other kids to be vaccinated so they won't catch whatever that disease is, whether it be measles or mumps or something like that. So I just like to know, what do you say to those kids who are immunocompromised who cannot take a vaccine and just have to, you know, and your kid is not vaccinated, and so you just put them, you know, in a place where they could actually catch something. I don't know how he deals with that, but I would like to know. I would love to ask RFK about that.
Another thing discussed in this report is pesticides, and that's mm-hmm. something that he's been railing against, pesticides in agriculture, for a long time. Now he's in this position, and this report states that children are exposed to an increasing number of synthetic chemicals, some of which have been linked to developmental issues and chronic disease. And people are looking for, okay, well, what is the action plan then? And they don't see an action plan here that, yeah, this is bad, but there's no, it seems status quo when it comes to these pesticides in agriculture.
Yeah, there is a lack of information, a lack of a plan in this report, certainly. A lot of it's like, here's what we think the problems are, here's what we can do about it. But yeah, you're right. A lot of this, there's a void of valuable information that we could use to say, all right, let's do that. Or, yeah, let's look into that. Let's research that. But there just isn't there.
Right. They're saying pesticides are bad in mm-hmm. our farming, but there mm-hmm. aren't recommendations on how to reduce mm-hmm. all of our exposure, right. Especially children's exposure to these toxic chemicals in food.
Let's stick on that, because the food process, I think, is one that we haven't the foresight into where the country would be moving in generations. There wasn't enough foresight into what that would look like.
Okay.
And with a growing population, what does that mean for the amount of food that we need?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what we ended up seeing, because it used to be you go to your local store and you buy your produce or you buy your meat, and that stuff came from a farm 50 miles away.
Sure.
There wasn't trucks, shipping back there,
right.
Frozen meat or vegetables right, from right. different. It just didn't exist.
Yeah.
Well, then it became, well, the population was growing at such a rate that you couldn't keep up with just your farmer from 50 miles down the road. Now you had to expand,
mm-hmm.
and it became a much bigger thing where we didn't anticipate how to keep up with that, how to feed people in a way that was going to continue to be healthy. And as a result, we've I think suffered from that.
Yeah.
And the farming process of our food, of our poultry, of our meat, you know, the deteriorating situation that these animals find themselves in. Yeah, it all contributes. It all contributes to our overall health, certainly. All right, we'll take a break. More coming up. It is our Wellness Wednesday look. It's next on JR Morning.
Stay here for All Talk with Kevin Dietz at 9. Now back to JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds on WJR, where Michigan comes to talk.
Today, September 10th, marks World Suicide Prevention Day, a time to raise awareness, break down stigma, and connect people with resources that can save lives. Suicide remains a leading cause of death worldwide, but conversations about mental health and community support can make a real difference. And joining us now on this Wellness Wednesday to talk about prevention efforts here in our community is Trent Sanford. He is Manager of Workforce Development and Innovation and Community Engagement with the Detroit Wayne Integrated Health Network. Trent, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am fine. And, you know, suicide is often called a silent epidemic. What do you think keeps so many people from speaking up about their struggles?
Wow. There are a number of things that keep people quiet about suicide. Primarily, I think it's the stigma associated with suicide, that people who choose to die by suicide have a character flaw, or somehow they're not strong-minded people.
And what does the data tell us about the suicide rates here in Wayne County in Detroit? I mean, how do they compete to maybe other areas or other cities, national trends?
We don't really have data that speaks directly to Wayne County or Detroit. The state data we have shows that suicide is one of the leading causes of death here in Michigan. And Michigan has an age-adjusted suicide rate of 14.7 per 100,000, which is higher than the national average. We rank about 34th out of 50.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And are there particular groups like young people, maybe veterans, first responders who are especially vulnerable right now?
Oh, yes. Among our youth, there's been a rapid increase in the number of suicides, particularly among young Black females and young Black males. There's been an explosive increase over the past 5 years or so. Let me see. Yeah, so the age-adjusted numbers show that youth ages between 5 and 24, there's like rates of suicide are about 15.2, which is a point higher than the national average.
Wow.
So, yeah. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to let you finish, and then I have a question.
Sure. So over 1,500 Michiganders died by suicide last year. That's roughly 4 people every day.
Wow.
My question was just about how folks who aren't in that space, who don't quite understand it, who, you know, you do think, like, how can you get to that point and leave the people you love? What would you tell those people? What don't we understand, and how can we help more?
We can tell people that suicide is not the problem. Suicide is what people think is an answer to a problem that they can't solve. And you really want to tell them to speak to someone who they trust, who cares about them, and hopefully that person can steer them toward some type of counseling or intervention that will help them understand the feelings that they're having. What we do know, what the data has shown us, is that a good number of people who die by suicide either have an undiagnosed or diagnosed mental illness, or they're under the influence of a substance. So, we want to try to connect people to resources that will help them understand what they're experiencing.
Yeah.
What kind of resources does DWIN provide, and how can they help people who may be in that space?
I'm glad you asked. DWIN is taking action. We've trained over 20,000 people in suicide prevention, including QPR, mental health first aid, CIT, and ASSIST training. Our crisis intervention team program trains over 200 officers and EMS responders annually to safely support individuals in suicidal crisis. We also operate mobile mental health clinics. We have a jail navigator program, homeless outreach teams, all of which screen for suicide risk and connect people to care.
Trent Sanford is manager of workforce development, innovation, and community engagement for the Detroit Wayne Integrated Health Network. Trent, it was great to talk with you, and thank you so much for giving your insight and giving us some great information on this September 10th World Suicide Prevention Day. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Can I add one thing?
Yes, you can.
There are two events coming up that we would like to encourage people to participate in. The NAMI Walk is coming up on, where is that? September 20th on the U of D campus. And then the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention has an Out of the Darkness Walk on September 27th.
Okay.
And then at 1 o'clock today, there will be a national moment of silence. The president of NAMI will have a national moment of silence.
Very good. Trent.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
It's important information.
Yeah. I mean, I've had, you know, a person in my family who had committed suicide, and, you know, it's a hard thing, man. Mm-hmm. You know, when they get into that dark space and, you know, you didn't know, they don't, many times, you know, they don't let you know, they don't make you seem like, you know, make it seem like they're going to do something like that. You know, there have been people that I know who tell you, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it. They don't, most of the time when it's done, they don't tell you, and you never really expect it. It just happens, you know, and it's a sad thing. So I'm glad we're talking about this, because there are some people probably listening right now who may be in that dark space, and I would love for them to get in touch with DWIHN at dwihn.org, DWIHN.org, and get some help, because help is there.
Certainly. This situation, you know, the mental health space is one that obviously we talk a lot about now, mm-hmm. and we've seen some of the side effects on the suicide part of things that people are dealing with. But then on the opposite side, where people are carrying out these horrific attacks, mm-hmm. like what we saw in Northern Michigan, and this kind of rally to bring back a facility where people could go to get help.
Michigan currently has 4 state-run psychiatric hospitals with 603 total staffed beds. That's according to some 2024 data. Well, that's clearly not enough with our mental health issues here in our state. And so now there's a proposal to create a mental health campus in Northern Michigan, which would provide the area with urgently needed inpatient and residential beds for youth and adults and outpatient treatments. So like this person who was struggling, the family knew he was struggling up north, maybe wouldn't have gone to Walmart. To do that horrific act. And so this is just right now a proposal in that area of our state. It calls for a continuum of care, evidence-based therapies, more beds. And I don't know where this goes from here, since it's just in proposal form. But this is something that people have been talking about for a while now. Maybe we have to go back to that model.
Yeah, it's something to certainly try. Also coming up at 8:49, we've got 8:49. We've got Name That Tune today, and we'll give you an opportunity to win those tickets coming up towards the end of the show. Meanwhile, is this a new answer to homelessness in the city of Lansing? They are considering it. We'll tell you what it is coming up on JR Morning.
About 33,226 Michiganders experienced homelessness in 2023. And that was an uptick of about 2% from the year prior. Homelessness is a problem. The city of Lansing is trying to do something about it. That's today's Capitol Report, sponsored by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. What is Lansing doing? Well, a pod city may be the answer. Let's ask Nick Cook, Director of Public Policy for the Michigan Coalition Against Homelessness, his thoughts on this idea. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
So in Lansing, the numbers are 2,300 or so people utilized emergency shelters there. So they have a homeless problem there. What are they trying to do about it? What's this new idea?
What the city has decided is to purchase pods that were owned by a nonprofit out of Kalamazoo, move them to Lansing. In Kalamazoo, it was tried to run by a nonprofit. They tried to work it into the city. Didn't work out. So the city actually purchased these pods. They moved them to Lansing. Now they're trying to determine where to place them in the city, then to house a group of unhoused individuals that live on private property on the north side of Lansing. So they have about 65 people that live in that encampment.
And Nick, you know, this plan, it really goes beyond just the housing part. I mean, because it's including wraparound services like, you know, job assistance and health care and counseling. It's pretty important to, you know, pair housing with these types of services, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. You know, that is the best practice for these types of, modular, pod type shelters, because really that's what it is. It's not permanent housing. It's more of a shelter, is to have those wraparound services that so somebody can move into permanency. You know, people are homeless for a variety of reasons. It can be physical health, mental health, substance use disorder, lack of jobs, or it could have been they had one bad day and they became overcome by bills and they just couldn't maintain their place of living. So, you want those wraparound services, and you also need it around a transportation system, a near transportation line, because if people can't get to work, they can't move into a permanent housing.
All right, so what are those specifics here? Where will this be located? Is there a particular piece of property that they're looking at? And how much is it going to cost the taxpayers in Lansing?
Well, that is the location is to be determined. They are still working on that with the city council. They have not made an announcement of where it's going to be. The pods were purchased relatively inexpensively. They said it's about just around $600,000 for the pods. And for ongoing costs, you're looking at $750,000 to $900,000 every year.
Mm. Now, these pods won't be operational, Nick, I understand, until at least March of next year. I'm wondering what happens in the meantime for the people who still don't have safe housing through these winter months ahead.
That is the question. What is the city of Lansing going to do during these winter months when we know, as Michiganders, as we all know, our winters are harsh. And those people that live out in these encampments because they don't have safe housing options or, the shelters are full. I mean, it can be dangerous. So not being put in place till March makes these individuals have to live through another Michigan winter.
Nick, homelessness is a national issue. It's been talked about when the president talked about the National Guard coming into the capital of Washington, D.C., and then, quote, getting the homeless people out of here. But what is the answer when it's true people who are walking downtown want to feel safe, but these are also human beings that can't just be shuffled around?
You're exactly right. Nationally, the president has put a lot of pressure on the homeless community, calling them vagrants, talking about crime, making a marginalized population feel even more marginalized. A lot of individuals are just trying to survive from day to day. They have families, they have jobs, they have substance use disorder. They're like everybody else. They just don't have a house. You look at the executive orders that the president put out. He called them vagrants, called them, criminals, but he didn't invest in anything to actually increase the options to get into housing, to get more wraparound services. He actually, in his budget proposal, actually reduced the amount of investment into homeless programs.
I guess on the flip side, if you look at places like California, where these encampments kind of grew and grew and grew, and they kind of took over these large swaths of areas, you know, you've got business owners in these areas will saying, oh, now people aren't coming because this homeless population is here and it makes it difficult. It's not an attractive spot for my clients to come or my customers to come here. Are we seeing, though, a bit of a shift in the way that states are addressing this issue? To me, this is a much more logical way to help these people without just putting them in an area where they're allowed to build tents.
Right. It is a tool in the toolkit. It is an option for communities. Communities have to decide what's best for them. Lansing decided this is the best option. Some communities will develop more shelters. Some will develop more motelling. It just really depends on what that community feels works best for their community. You know, what we want is those wraparound services, and we want to transition somebody from the streets to permanent housing. And how you get there is dependent on the city and the community.
Well, Nick Cook, we appreciate your time talking about this, our Capitol report about what's happening in Lansing, Michigan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the latest there in Lansing is they're looking for bids for someone, a contractor, to sort of service these pods because there's costs there and someone needs to do that. And then there's public speaking sessions coming up in October for the public to say, yes, I like it. No, I don't like it here. Here are my thoughts, my business, my home, what have you.
Well, that's good that people are, they're including people, including the residents.
But it's a problem and a solution. Yes. I think that's something.
If you can find a good spot for these pods and people can spend, you know, the short amount of time there, it's supposed to be transitional. It's not supposed to be long term. I think it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, for that amount of money, I mean, that seems logical.
Without building a brick and mortar shelter.
Exactly.
Makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
Makes a lot of sense.
Lots coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. Do you want to spend more for your entertainment tickets and sports tickets? We'll answer that question.
On your ride home, check out the Mitch Albom Show at 4 p.m. Now to get your day started, here's JR Morning with Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson, and Jamie Edmonds.
8:05, good to have you this morning. Still a lot to do this hour, but this story about the fake electors, this was a case going back to the 2020 election, leading up or that night, there was a group of electors that had signed a paper that said that Donald Trump had won the election. And they did that because as the vote was certified in Michigan after the election, that there was still questions floating around by the president of the United States at the time that the election was stolen and it was rigged. And these set of electors were signing in the event that there was facts proven that the election was stolen. As a result, we know how things played out, and charges were brought against these folks, and now we've got movement on that.
That's right. A Michigan judge has dismissed the criminal charges against 15 Republicans accused of attempting to falsely certify President Trump as the winner of the 2020 election in our state. And District Court Judge Christian Simmons ruled yesterday that the defendants, including some high-profile party members, acted without criminal intent. She says whether they were right or wrong or indifferent, they seriously believe there were problems with the election. And she said, noting that they were just exercising their constitutional right to seek redress. The group had faced multiple charges for forgery and conspiracy with potential prison sentences of up to 14 years. And supporters and family members cheered outside the courtroom while the defendants embraced in relief. Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel, well, she called the ruling disappointing and indicated her office may appeal, arguing the defendants knowingly circumvented election procedures. The dismissal marks a major setback for prosecutors amid some similar challenges in other states over the same 2020 election-related case.
Interesting.
The judge saying that there's not evidence to prove intent. That these electors did not know that there was this plan to sort of overturn anything, that came from Trump and Republican lawyers higher up than them.
And these people really thought that there was an issue. And
right, wrong, or indifferent, they seriously believed that there were problems with the election.
And they were just seeking redress like anybody else would have in that situation.
Interesting.
Despite the White House trying to downplay all this, the Epstein story continues. Mm-hmm. It remains. And the Wall Street Journal posted lots of letters, not just the alleged one from the president, but lots of letters in this birthday book that are just gross. And it shows that everyone thought it was funny and it was something to be made fun of because there was a lot of sexual content in these letters and young women being referenced in these young letters. The book overall is gross. But the story continues. The president says that's not his signature.
It's not my signature, and it's not the way I speak. And anybody that's covered me for a long time knows that's not my language. It's nonsense. And frankly, you're wasting your time. All you do is trying to get off the great success of D.C. and about 200 other things we've done that are so successful.
Byron Donald's also saying, like, yeah, he knows for sure that's not the president's signature.
From what I see, it's not a signature. I've seen Donald Trump sign a million things.
This doesn't look like his signature to you?
Nope. Doesn't look like it. I've watched him sign nonstop.
Oh, nonstop. Okay, so okay. He knows for sure. And finally, Caroline Leavitt at the podium yesterday. It seemed like the reporters were banding together and continuing to ask the same question of her. And here she is on the Epstein letter.
I did not say the documents are a hoax. I said the entire narrative surrounding Jeffrey Epstein right now that is absorbing many of the liberal cable channels on television is a hoax that is being perpetuated by opportunistic Democrats like Ro Khanna and the others whom you saw on that press conference outside of Capitol Hill who are trying to push this hoax against the President of the United States.
I think to Chris's point earlier, hoax is the wrong word. Because there are victims.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There is someone who perpetrated this scheme. There's there someone in prison over it.
Correct.
So hoax is the wrong word.
The documents were real. And documents were.
Now, you can say that the president didn't have anything to do with it.
Sure. Yeah.
And that you kind of cornering him into this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a hoax. This is something real that happened.
I don't know why can't you just say, like, okay, they were friends back in the 90s, but he didn't know what was going on. There are a lot of people, according to the Wall Street Journal, in this book that sign letters. Like Vera Wang is in this letter sending happy birthday sentiment to Jeffrey Epstein. Do I think Vera Wang was involved with everything? No.
No, and I
don't know, I guess. But
No. But I think that this idea, you know, the Bulwark did a little sit down with some folks and asked them. Now, the Bulwark is a political commentary publication. They generally tend to take a anti-Trump perspective. Which is fine, but they asked people, like, is this a big deal for you? People who voted for Joe Biden in 2020, but then came back to Donald Trump in 2024. So they voted for this guy.
Right.
They asked if this was a big deal. And most of them said, no.
No. Yeah.
It's not a big deal because this doesn't change my gas bills. This doesn't change how much I'm spending at the grocery store. This is what really matters to people. Now, they also said, but you talked about this. And when you talked about this on the campaign trail, we expected you to follow through on it. Mm-hmm. And now that it's here, you're not following through on it. So what else are you not going to follow through on? Reasons that we voted for you. So I think it's a very fair way of looking at it. Like, I don't really necessarily care. This doesn't impact my day to day. Not to trivialize what happened.
Right.
But it doesn't impact most people's day to day. But it's also something you said. And you should probably follow through on it. It's an interesting perspective. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released their revision of the year March to March, March 2024 to March 2025, and there were about almost a million jobs fewer than were reported. It's problematic.
That's the issue.
I mean, the economy is not as robust as the picture that was painted for us. And that impacts hiring. It impacts the way companies are looking at things. It impacts where the government is looking to spend money, how they allocate budgets and things like that. All of this is tied in. And when you overshoot by that much,
it's problematic.
Yeah. It's like, I got to drive to Disney and my tank says it's full, but I make it to Toledo.
Right. Exactly.
I thought I had more. I thought I had more oomph here, but we don't.
Well, you can make the argument that the way they get this information isn't working anymore because they do it through surveys from business owners and businesses, big and small. And only 43% of employers responded to the survey, down from 60% before the pandemic. So maybe big ones consistently respond. Smaller companies consistently maybe are starting not to respond. And then when that starts to slow, then you have to estimate what you think is happening. Then when you get actual numbers, you revise.
Well, then, but why? I guess what changed in that, in the reporting, in the response
they're not responding. So yeah, then
but
you
why?
Have to.
What happened? I mean, yeah, that's what we don't know.
That's what we don't know. That's the question.
I just like what changed that is dictating this kind of guesswork that they're doing at that level.
That
doesn't make a lot of sense.
Do you want to respond to surveys monthly?
No, but I'm not in that world.
I think maybe the
if I'm a business owner, that's kind of one of the things that you sign up for. You got a report. That's not something I want to do.
I think maybe looking at the system is a good thing
sure.
to do.
Absolutely. So. Start there.
Guys, you know, the auto show is coming. It's going to be here in maybe, about another 4 or 5 months. They're announcing their first 4 major automakers confirmed to appear at the event. Organizers say Ford, General Motors, Stellantis, Toyota will all be on hand for the show, which runs from January 14th to the 25th at Huntington Place. Show Chairman Todd Zott said in a statement that organizers are incredibly appreciative of the automakers' commitment to the city's automotive heritage. Executive Director Sam Clement added that having these 4 companies at the forefront underscores just how important Detroit remains in the global auto industry. The show will also see the return of some popular features. Racing Day, in partnership with the Chevy Detroit Grand Prix, will be back with a demo track and an IndyCar driver session. The gallery and ultra luxury vehicle showcase also confirmed to return. Full schedule includes Media and Industry Days, January 14th and 15th, the charity preview, of course, on the 16th, and the public show runs from January 17th through the 25th.
If the big 3 and the big 4, when you include Toyota, if they're not at that...
If they said, I'm not coming, then we'd be like, uh-oh.
Yeah, the fact that they're all going to be there is a good sign. Meanwhile, you want to pay more for big events downtown to help property tax issues in the city of Detroit? Something that's being proposed. It's talked about. We'll talk about it coming up on JR Morning.
We've been talking about this idea of a ticket tax here in the city of Detroit. And 34 states have some form of this admissions or amusement tax. And it can go from 3% to 10%. And cities like ours, Atlanta, Chicago, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, Denver, Indianapolis, Philly, and my hometown of Pittsburgh do this. And it generates revenue. And the Citizens Research Council looked into what it would be like if it happened here. Eric Lufer is on the phone with us now. He's the president of this council. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, so let's talk about this ticket tax, this ticket idea that's been talked about recently. You did this study, and at the highest end, it could bring in almost $50
million. Yeah, $50 million, and that sounds like a lot, but you have to keep in mind the city's budget is $1.7 million. So it's important. It's a lot of money. It can help do a lot of things or provide property tax relief, but it's only part of the puzzle for funding Detroit city government.
And I know you've said that, you know, if the tax isn't structured right, it might not be worth the effort. What would the right structure look like?
Well, it's for us, it was trying to find that mix of not being so high that people want to stop coming to games and making the team owners think about moving out to Pontiac or Auburn Hills again or things like that. Is it enough to raise some revenue to help the city, but not being so high to be obtrusive in interfering with economic activity?
Sounds like it's a bit of a tough sell at this point, only because ticket prices for events have never been higher. I mean, it's almost impossible for a family of 4 to go to a Lions game or to go to a few games a year down at Comerica Park. It's becoming more of a challenge for people.
It does become a bit of a regressive tax in that way, but we don't feel it's so much because the tax is such a high rate that it would change behavior, but the tax you're applying, the item you're applying the tax to, tends to be very expensive. So it's already difficult for me to justify taking a family down to a Lions game or something like that because the price is so much. But if I do go down there, I am consuming city services. I am benefiting from the police being there, and if something were to happen, EMS responding to my needs. The streets being paved and garbage being collected and things like that. So I, as a consumer of the event, a patron of the event, want to feel safe going to and coming from that. who should pay for that?
So is that where that money would go towards? Is that general fund money?
Yeah, so in Michigan, a local government can only levy a tax if the legislature says it would. So it would be up to the legislature and Detroit City Council to decide where that money goes.
Sure.
As we looked at other cities, you mentioned a bunch at the beginning, many of them are using it for public safety, right? It's sort of feeding back. We also see some cities using that money for youth sports. So you can see a bit of a loop there because there's athletes coming, professional athletes coming. You can help young athletes. We mm-hmm. also talked about funding a Detroit Sports Commission to be able to bring in big events, bring in the next Super Bowl, bring in the next NCAA tournament, things like that. There's a bit of a buy-in needed for something like that. So revenues from this could help fund that. And again, it's a feedback loop. Those people would pay that same tax, and that would help the city to do all the things it needs to do.
Ken Hayward has talked about that on this air before, that they need the money in hand
the
to say go to the NBA and say we're ready for an All-Star game instead of we will have the money if you give
right.
us the All-Star
exactly.
game. Right. When you talk about a percentage, whatever these cities do, 3 to 10%, what is the dollar amount at the lowest level there that would add to our tickets? Do you have that data?
Yeah, at that 3%, we estimate the city would bring in about $15 million. And this depends a little bit. When the teams are doing well, a lot of people are attending the events. But you can think back a few years when you could have any ticket, any seat you wanted in LCA to watch a Pistons game because there were so few people there. When they're doing poorly, the city would suffer in revenues. At that high range, about 10%, as much as $50 million in revenue. Pretty wide range, but the ticket, the percentage varies.
I'm wondering if you have the dollar amount for the person going to the game. Like, how much extra is the 3%?
Yeah. So if you think about a $100 ticket, and I say that realizing you can't even get close to Ford Field for a Lions game at $100, but $100 ticket, the 3% tax, you're going to pay $3 extra. A 10% tax, you're going to be $10 extra. The Taylor Swift concert's a whole lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Tiger game, depending on where you're sitting, you could pay as much as $100. I think the last time I went in, I paid $25 or something to sit up in the nosebleed seats.
You know, we have a mayoral election coming up, and you got candidates like Mary Sheffield who, you know, really leaning on this issue as a campaign talking point. You see the emissions tax maybe becoming a defining debate in this election?
I think it certainly will be. The city has been on a good economic path, a lot of recovery, but it only benefits from part of the new growth, the new interest in the city. People who have a business, who live in the city, pay property taxes. That's one form of economic activity. Anybody working in the city, such as you guys, are paying income tax to the city. But anybody attending these events, dining in restaurants, purchasing at the stores in the city doesn't benefit from that. So you can feel good that there's a lot of economic activity downtown on a weekend night and people milling about. The city benefits from those stores paying property taxes and income tax, but all that new consumption, all that purchasing going on doesn't benefit the city. And the tax we're looking at is one element of that that would help the city be able to better do the things that it wants to do and breed more success.
Well, Eric Lufer, we appreciate you coming on, talking about this research and what it would mean for us and what it would mean for the city. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
I mean, yeah. $3, $10 doesn't seem like that much.
No, and because if you're already paying those high prices anyway, you know, the extra $3 or $10, you know, but it's like, what is the money going towards? You know, that's the thing that the legislature and the city council will have to decide. And, you know, as the sports commission talked about before, they like to have money up front when they go after these big events that they're trying to get here, as opposed to having to raise the money once they are given the event.
Yeah, I'd like to see where the money goes.
Yeah.
I'd like to see who's getting this money. I'd like to see where it's being allocated.
That's where the sell comes in. And that's politicians. It.
Correct. Yes. That's where the Lansing lawmakers come into play.
All right, coming up, a ruling that could reshape the nation when it comes to foreign aid. The Supreme Court has spoken. That's at 8:35.
I did not say the documents are a hoax.
So back and forth we go in the courts. This time, the High Court, the Supreme Court, has temporarily allowed the Trump administration to freeze $4 billion in foreign aid while it appeals a lower court ruling ordered that those funds need to be released. Richard Friedman's law professor at the University of Michigan and joins us once again on this issue. It's good to have you back. This idea of constitutional limits, particularly from the executive branch, comes into play here when it involves congressionally allocated funds, and now the Supreme Court has weighed in here.
Right. Congress appropriated these funds, and the president doesn't want to spend them. And so that's the basic underlying issue. It's gotten involved in a terrific snarl about procedures and how it should be enforced and all. So I think that they might not even get to the underlying issue as to whether the president can refuse. We're now in a situation in which the president has taken advantage of what's called the Impoundment Control Act, which is an act meant to limit the ability of the president to decline to spend money. But a provision of that gives the president the ability to submit what's called a rescission request to say, hey, Congress, I don't want to spend this money. And then Congress has 45 days to decide that. And the president is saying now, okay, I just made my rescission request, and I really can't spend the money in the next 45 days. And guess what? September 30th, the time to spend it expires. So effectively, he's trying to run out the clock.
So in this case, Professor, really seems to strike at the heart of separation of powers. And so in your view, is this more about the foreign aid or about testing the limits of presidential authority versus Congress?
Well, that is the underlying issue, the ability of Congress to say, hey, we really do want you to spend this money. You know, now in this particular case, it's being fought out over foreign aid and over particular aspects of foreign aid in which the president says, you know, I don't like that. It doesn't square with my policy.
So,
the big issue is can Congress effectively require the president to spend money?
So the administration wants to withhold $4 billion in foreign aid, but it says it's going to still spend $6.5 billion Congress appropriated. So what's the legal distinction between the two pots of money, or is this just simply about executive discretion?
Well, I think the president exercised discretion in deciding to send in the rescission request with respect to the $4 billion and not with respect to the other $6.5 billion. So I think that he decided, okay, he's willing to spend the $6.5 billion, but it's these $4 billion he didn't want to. And I don't know to what extent he or the administration was really motivated by a strong desire not to spend that money, and to what extent they kind of wanted to present the issue to say, hey, if we make this late rescission request, you know, within 45 days of the time the funds expire, we don't have to spend it.
But what did the Supreme Court say specifically in this ruling by Chief Justice John Roberts? They didn't say that this is the final decision on it, that this was their final appeal or opinion on it. The appeal by the federal government is happening at a lower court.
Yeah. So, well, it's now before the Supreme Court. What happened was the district court entered the injunction, and this is after a whole lot of procedure. The Court of Appeals declined to stay the injunction. This was a new panel. A previous panel had thrown out a prior injunction. I mean, this is, case has been going on for a while. So then the government went to the Supreme Court and asked for a stay. And what they sometimes do in this case is enter a single justice can enter what's called an administrative stay, which says just hold on for a few minutes, you know, for several days, a week or two, while we figure this out. And the plaintiffs, the organizations that are trying to get the government to spend the money, put in a rather unusual document saying, please don't enter an administrative stay, because if you do, it's going to stop the clock. And even if we win in the end, the government is saying they're not going to have enough time before September 30th to commit the funds. So they put that in the other day, and last night the Chief Justice did enter the administrative stay. So he didn't say much at all, just sort of said, okay, plaintiffs, you've got to respond by Friday, and then they'll consider whether to enter a longer stay. But that was a win for the government, because by its lights, it's narrowing the time in which it could comply with the injunction, even if the court does let it go into effect. So I think that's the suggestion, that the handwriting is on the wall, that the government is going to win.
Let me ask you about something else. The tariffs, the sweeping tariffs all across the world, this has been an issue that, you know, businesses have brought up. And Scott Bessent is saying that, you know, we're going to have to give back a lot of this money. We got to figure this out. The Supreme Court says, okay, we'll figure this out in an expedited timeline.
Yeah. Right. Right. The government asked for an expedited timeline, and the challengers there didn't resist. I think they didn't even strenuously resist the court taking the case on, because I think it's pretty obvious that the court would take this case. I mean, you have a federal court of appeals that held this massive program to be unconstitutional. So even though there's no conflict among the lower courts, this is the type of case I think that the Supreme Court would likely take. And it's to everybody's interest, I think, that it be resolved quickly. The plaintiffs, the challengers there, want it resolved quickly because they're saying we're being required to pay taxes that we shouldn't. And from the government's standpoint, I think it's best that it be resolved quickly, because if they lose and they have to refund the taxes, well, that's, you know, the tariffs, that's a whole lot of money going backwards, you know. So it's going to be a very interesting situation, I think.
Does that affect, will it affect the economy? Will it affect the stocks, the markets, if we have to give that money back?
Boy, if I knew which way the stock market was going to go,
you wouldn't be on the phone with us. Yeah.
that might be. It's a big deal, you know. Don't know what it will do. But look, the fact is that if the tariffs were imposed unconstitutionally, I think they were. I don't think the president had a valid basis for doing it, then that's tax money that's been collected that shouldn't have been and should be refunded. And let the chips fall where they may, I think, is the appropriate response, you know. And look, the administration should have been aware of this possibility. I mean, they knew they were doing an aggressive thing, and so they knew that there's a possibility that ultimately it's going to be held unlawful, and they've taken a chance. You know, we'll see, but I think the challengers have the better of the case there.
Richard Friedman, law professor at the University of Michigan. Always appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You got it.
Bye-bye.
All right, Wet Your Whistle. Name That Tune's next.